From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. General Motors, the world's number one car maker, is perhaps still the iconic American corporation. GM earns more than $180 billion a year and employs more than 150,000 Americans. Many, many more depend indirectly on General Motors for their livelihoods. Now, GM is in trouble. Analysts say real trouble. Tonight on Point, the symbol of America's 20th century industrial might, General Motors, in a fight for its life. But first tonight, Walmart announced today that it will pay $11 million to settle federal allegations that it knowingly had hundreds of illegal immigrants cleaning its stores, many working 7 days or nights a week without overtime pay or injury compensation. Overnight workers were often locked inside Walmart stores they cleaned. Walmart's fine is the highest ever paid in a civil immigration settlement. Wendy Zellner has been following the story for Business Week and joins me now. Wendy, thanks for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
First, to clarify, these were contractors to Walmart for the cleaning who actually employed these men, but Walmart is being held responsible. How? Why?
Well, Walmart is still saying that they did not know that these were illegal workers. And in fact, that's one of the reasons the Justice Department decided not to go ahead with a criminal case. So it is settling a civil case and basically saying what we do acknowledge is that we weren't policing our contractors very well.
250 illegal immigrants at least at 60 Walmart stores across the country and from all over the place. 25 from the Czech Republic, 90 from Mexico, 22 from Mongolia. Why did Walmart get targeted here if it's sort of the secondary employer?
Well, I think because it had a prior instance as well. Some of these cases, I think, back in 2001, there was a series of enforcement actions that involved 100 illegal aliens. So the government's been tracking this for some time in that Pennsylvania district. And then in 2003, they followed up with a raid of, as you said, the 60 stores in those 21 states. So, and I think also having the biggest employer in the country certainly sends a big signal for the government to settle a case like this.
Well, I wonder just about that, Wendy. I'm thinking how many corporations of one kind and another employ subcontractors to clean their premises, and how many of those must hire illegals?
I think you're right about that, and this certainly the Justice Department is trying to say we're not going to tolerate it. If we could go after Walmart, you know, you might be next. And certainly $11 million, it's, as you said, a record settlement for the government, but it's not a lot of money for Walmart, which had $285 billion in sales last year. So I think they're just happy to put this behind them.
$280 billion and 1.2 million domestic workers. What is Walmart promising to do now in terms of tracking the immigration status of its employers, or I guess even its subcontractors' employers?
Well, they are saying that they are putting tougher language now in the contracts with their maintenance firms that they still use from the outside, that they're going to centralize the control of the contract, so they should have better control that way, and that any store-level contracts over $10,000 will have to be approved by officers of the company. But it's still not yet clear, I guess, whether that will stop illegal workers from getting through the next time around.
And Walmart is not finished with legal challenges around this case. I understand there's still a case in the New Jersey courts. Could there be something big in the offing, or is this all small potatoes in financial terms for Walmart?
Well, there's certainly some civil cases now against the company filed by lawyers for some of the illegal workers. I think Walmart believes that it has gotten a big plus here by, you know, having the government essentially not hold them liable on criminal charges, and you know, they continue to insist that they did not know, you know, no corporate company executives knew that this was going on.
Any sign, Wendy, that there's a wider campaign afoot here to go after illegal labor in the United States?
Well, the government says that that is certainly part of their plan, but I think they've shown in the past that this is something that is very hard for them to police and control, and there's, you know, sporadic cases, but whether there will be anything systematic that they can really do remains to be seen.
So on the technical immigration issues, not a heavy wrap here, but Walmart's also been engaged in labor negotiations and taken, or I should say, in a kind of an ongoing fight with labor about its general labor practices. These reports of workers locked in stores, paid no overtime, no injury compensation, even in the vicinity of Walmart, is not going to help improve its image in that conversation, is it?
Well, no. I don't think this will help them, certainly, with the unions. And their view of Walmart, but This takes this case out of the public eye, and that's good news for them.
One step on. Wendy Zellner, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Wendy Zellner, Dallas Bureau Chief for Business Week. She spoke with us from Dallas. From Chevrolet to Cadillac to Saab and Hummer, General Motors makes more cars and trucks than any other company in the world. GM is one of this country's largest employers and has been for decades. It is the country's largest private provider of health care coverage. Its pension plans support hundreds of thousands of retired Americans. So when GM shocked the markets by sharply revising its earnings downward this week, it was more than just shareholders who felt the chill. GM's debt is now teetering on junk bond status. Analysts are asking how or whether the company can be turned around. Tonight on Point, America's number one auto manufacturer, GM, in a very real struggle to survive. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you paid attention to what's going on with GM? Can you imagine America without General Motors, with a much smaller GM? Can you imagine it soon? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Micheline Maynard, New York Times reporter and author of The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. Micheline, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Sean McAlinden, chief economist and vice president of the Center for Automotive Research, a nonprofit spinoff of the University of Michigan. Sean McAlinden, thank you for joining us.
Oh, good evening.
Mickey Maynard, first to you. Take us into this. A lot of heads were turned this week with these numbers. GM been trying to hold on to something like 30% of U.S. market share. It was down to 27%, now down to 24%, something like that. What's the range of possibilities this company is now facing?
Well, just to give you a little bit of perspective on this, back in about 1960, General Motors alone had almost 60% of the car market, and even 10 years ago, it had 35%. So it's lost about one-third of its share in the last 10 years. I think that this crisis has been building for quite a while. If you go back to the year 2000, General Motors was really on a roll. Their stock was selling for almost $80 a share. And even a year ago, it was selling at about $50 a share, and they were telling investors that by the middle of this decade, they would be making $10 a share. Well, what they said this week was that they expect a loss of $1.50 a share in the first quarter alone. That works out to almost $900 million, and that they expect to only earn $1 to $2 a share this year versus the $3 or $4 that they had once said they would earn for this year. And basically, it's basically one-tenth of what they had hoped to be earning at this point in time.
And with that, Mickey, we're seeing every kind of prognosis here, all the way from maybe, possibly, somehow a turnaround to a vastly smaller GM to even people talking about a bankrupt GM carved up and not GM as we know it.
Well, I don't think the GM as we know it will be around, say, in the year 2010. I see the possibility that they could lose another 3 to 4 points of market share. I think they could end up at around 20% of the car market. And one of the reasons is they face tremendous competition, particularly from Toyota. And this is one of the stories that I've explored when I was working on my book. What people don't understand is that Toyota is on a path to become the largest car maker in the world. And if they do get there, they will become the most, they are already the most profitable car maker in the world. And they'll do this by being strong in four different places, in Japan, of course, in Europe, in the United States, and also in other parts of Asia. Whereas General Motors for so long was focused solely on North America, it only really focused on its European operations over, say, the last 15 years. And in the last couple of years, it's been focused tremendously on China. And while all that has been happening, it has been losing share tremendously in its home market.
Sean McAlinden, GM stock price down $4.70 since this week to $29, down from the $80 in 2000 that Mickey's pointing to. That puts its market value at $16 billion, less than motorcycle maker Harley-Davidson, one-eighth that of Toyota. What are the elements beyond competition that are pushing GM down?
Well, they're facing a lot of structural cost pressures at the same time. I think it's pretty well known that they got the largest health cost burden for retirees in the country.
This because they're carrying so many retirees.
130,000 of them, with hundreds of thousands of more dependents, and you know, essentially, in fact, they're one out of every $6 owed on pension liabilities in the S&P 500 as General Motors.
We read that between pension and health care obligations, it adds something like $1,800 to the price of every car GM sells.
At least. And, you know, then beyond that, the steel prices are up 50% this year. They're restructuring their European operations. They've had to make a very large cash payment to Fiat to get out of a bad deal there. You know, they've had to cut prices in China. Some of this stuff is recent. You know, the overall trend, of course, in the market is they've been running a rebate campaign for 4 years now, now up over $5,000 a vehicle. And that works out to, even with a few price increases and get through, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 billion a year on rebates. Mm.
And if Mickey Maynard is right, if yeah. GM as we know it is gone by 2010, that is not long from now, what kind of impact on the U.S. economy?
They're about 1% of gross domestic product.
Sounds small, but that's big.
Well, yeah, they used to be 2%, but the, you know, the interesting part is that the internationals are investing in the U.S. and building new plants, and, you know, part of the, you know, GM presence in manufacturing will be replaced by foreign direct investment because, you know, because of currency risk and because it's a good place to build cars generally, and these are companies without legacy costs and with good product, and that part of will be placed in the economy. There's more of a short-run risk perhaps in debt markets because of GM's, you know, the size of GM's bond portfolio.
We'll talk about that. Sean McElinda and Mickey Maynard, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the fate of GM. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's number one auto manufacturer, General Motors, in a very real struggle to survive. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Have you plugged in to the suddenly urgent reality of GM's shaky foundation, its very uncertain future? Can you picture the United States of America without the heartbeat of America? Without Chevrolet, Pontiac, Buick, Saturn, GMC, without General Motors? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight by from Ann Arbor, Michigan, by Micheline Mickey Maynard. She's a New York Times reporter and author of The End of Detroit. And from Ann Arbor, Sean McElinden, chief economist and vice president of the Center for Automotive Research. It's a nonprofit spun off there from the University of Michigan. Mickey Maynard, if I may, a couple of things. First, on sales, Sean points out that the money back
rebates,
the rebates have been very high, and still sales have been weak. They recently brought in Robert Lutz not so long ago to help kick up the styling and kick up the sales. What's happened on the sales front?
Well, a couple of things have happened on the sales front. First of all, the internet. I think what's happened to GM in particular is that consumers today are extremely savvy about what vehicles are worth, and GM's problem has been twofold. One has been some of the styling in the past was kind of stodgy, and it takes a long time to shake that image. So every so often you'll see General Motors trying a sort of a remake of Buick or a remake of Saturn, and they've been successful definitely with their overhaul of Cadillac. But
hot as a pistol right now.
Exactly, but those images just sort of cling to General Motors like clay soil, and I think that consumers can look at data on the internet. They can look at recall data. They can look at residual values. They can look at resale values. And they can just go across the numbers. Consumer Reports just came out with a big study a couple of weeks ago on the best cars in the country. And I think 23 out of 24 of them were Japanese, and the only American one was the Ford Focus. So that's one of the things. I think another issue that General Motors faces is this constant on sale, you know, sort of turning cars into furniture. And if you go back to the 2001 attacks, one of the things that GM did right after those attacks, mm-hmm. they put on 0% financing.
Right.
And it brought hordes of people to showrooms. In fact, car sales in October that year were the strongest they've basically been in history for a single month. But when the dust settled, the market shares actually didn't change. And in fact, the Japanese and the German companies actually gained market share. What General Motors had done was sort of generate momentum, but it didn't generate momentum for itself. People came out, went to showrooms, and then bought what they were going to buy anyway.
Sean McElinden, what about on the healthcare front? I mean, GM has such huge obligations there now. We see Standard & Poor's credit analyst saying yesterday that GM's hold on an investment grade rating, it's already triple B, and he's saying their hold even on that investment grade rating, that is keeping above junk bond status, is tenuous. The health care obligations and pension are a huge part of that. Let's looking at health care for a moment. It looks as though GM is beginning to lobby the government to get involved here somehow. What's the dynamic there?
Well, even the Medicare prescriptions bill that passed by Congress last year probably worked out to a $3 billion future saving for General Motors. So even small adjustments in federal support of medical care help General Motors. And, they're feeling, of course, this is not just a General Motors problem or an airlines or a steel company problem, but, a problem for much of the S&P 500 or any company that has retirees. And it's a problem for state and local governments and the Medicare system itself. And then they just happen to be a company that's had, unfortunately for them, restructured through natural attrition over the years and built themselves up a huge legacy bank in order to preserve labor peace and get more productive.
But I guess the question there is, with the huge demand for health care, the demands of that on their bottom line, is it possible? I mean, people used to say what's good for GM is good for America. Is it turning around now? Is it possible that what Bill Clinton and others failed to do to bring in universal health care coverage, somehow GM would do by going to the government and saying the American automotive industry will not survive unless you provide some more sweeping coverage?
They're not getting any response from the White House and from significant leadership in the Congress on this issue, and they have tried. There's no question about it. Constantly, every day, and every lobbying effort they can think of, every source, and there's some talk of possible catastrophic health care assistance in the future, which is where most of the cost for them lies. Nothing in the area of prescription drugs. We're not even allowed to import drugs from across the Detroit River in Canada. Well, we got to face imports, obviously, every morning at 6 o'clock all over the world. It's perceived as very unfair here, and it's not just a problem for General Motors, but they're going to be at the point end of this whole debate, I think, in their business situation in the months to come. And as this crisis builds, possibly focus attention on this major national issue.
It will certainly get people's attention if GM starts to very visibly wobble. Mickey Maynard, Sean McAlinden, stand by for a moment. I want to welcome into our conversation from Philadelphia, Sean Egan. He's managing director of the Egan Jones Rating Company. It's an independent debt rating firm, one of the first companies to sound the warning on Enron, on WorldCom, on Global Crossing, and now sounding a warning on General Motors. Sean Egan, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
So I have to say up front, you are known as one of the more pessimistic analysts on GM, but your analysis is pretty darn dark. How do you see the company?
We see the situation as being unsustainable, that if GM doesn't turn around things quickly, that they're going to continue to slide and they're going to be faced with a major restructuring probably within the next 2 years.
Within 2 years, for all of us lay people, describe exactly what you mean. When you say they're in big trouble and looking at restructuring, does it mean a bankruptcy? Does it mean the end of GM? Does it mean GM sliced and diced and sold off in pieces? Paint a picture for us.
It means that they cannot cover their current obligations. The company announced this week that they're going to take $840 million loss for the first quarter. They say they're going to make money for the entire year. We don't think that's going to happen with the rise in interest rates. They have about $300 billion in debt outstanding, and interest rates are over 1% higher now than they've been a year ago for GM. In fact, it's probably closer to 150 basis points.
And almost certainly to go higher still as Alan Greenspan tightens.
Exactly. So if you do the math, $300 billion times 1 or 1.5%, that's equal to roughly $4 billion plus the $800 million that they lost in the first quarter. That exceeds the earnings of last year, which means that they won't earn money this year probably, and in fact it'll get worse after that as these other problems creep up on them.
So if it gets worse, what happens? I mean, it doesn't, surely with all those factories and all that built up value of one kind and another, it doesn't just disappear, or does it?
The factories remain. They probably will be reallocated. The problem with GM is that they've negotiated these contracts where they have to continue paying 95% of the cost to the workers, so that even if they close the factories, they're still burdened with a cost. A good model for looking at this might be the airline industry, whereby the jobs were cut back, but the airline, the planes are still flying. In the case of GM, unless they turn things around quickly, they're going to have to look at severe cutbacks. Typically, that happens under the court's auspices. We'll see what happens here.
Mickey Maynard, the management at GM. Rick Wagner and others are saying they're counting on a new wave of medium and large-size SUVs and large pickup trucks coming in 06 and 07 to turn their fortunes around. How reasonable does that look?
Well, the last time I bought gas, it was $2.09 a gallon, and if I lived in Santa Monica, California, I'd be paying $3 a gallon. So I think their timing is going to be pretty bad with these vehicles. I'm not criticizing the vehicles themselves. I'm sure that in another era, say in the year 2000, it would have been terrific to have these vehicles coming. But I think there's another issue involved here, is that General Motors has not gotten serious about hybrid electric vehicles, and this year Toyota is introducing hybrid electric sport utility vehicles, more hybrid electric cars, and GM is just now introducing its very first hybrid electric pickup truck. So I think their timing is just awful.
Sean,
they're off the mark. They're off the mark with product. They're off the mark with cost. And they're off the mark with their overall the type of vehicle that people are looking for. It's not the SUV. They should be focusing on the sedans. People are not going to buy the 7-passenger SUV the way they used to, with the gas going up the way it has been.
Sean Egan, I know I've just cut you for another minute. How do you imagine the knock-on effect of General Motors, if it, as you say, within 2 years ceases to exist as we know it? What's the impact on the U.S. economy? Is it not much change because Toyota factories open up or GM closes, or somewhere else, but the job number stays the same, or is it a devastating impact?
In the short run, it'll be a devastating impact. Keep in mind that there are 320,000 employees of GM. If you add in all their suppliers, you're looking at north of 1 million employees. Ford is not in terrific shape either. So auto-related jobs are probably north of 2 million people. Obviously, if both companies get into severe trouble, not all those jobs are going away, but it's going to be hurt, especially in the Midwest.
Mm. Sean Egan, Managing Director at Egan Jones, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I want to turn to our callers. A lot have been waiting to join us. Jake is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Jake. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to start with a short story about a friend of mine who went to school in Michigan for engineering. He had known a couple engineers who were doing rather poorly in school, and he was wondering how they had planned on getting jobs once they graduated.
Okay.
And a majority of them said, well, my dad works for GM, my dad works for Ford, name your American car company. I've already got a job waiting for me. I don't need to do well in school.
You mean it was just a family affair? If you were part of the family, you were hired, whether you were the best engineer or not?
Very much so. And I think that a lot of the fault lies on the fact that these American car companies, especially GM and Ford, the ones that I know about at least, weren't really putting forth their best foot and were actually hiring engineers not based on excellence or any kind of merit, but based simply on the fact that their father had worked there, perhaps their father's father had worked there.
Make some happy families in the short term, but long term, it's hard to win that way. Sean McElinden, what about is there a kind of calcified bureaucracy within GM that might speak to what Jake's describing?
Oh, I don't think it's an engineering. I think GM has attempted and largely succeeded in hiring some of the best mechanical engineers in the country for many years. If there's calcification, it's been in marketing. You know, they don't want to lose their older buyers, so they can't change the cars to attract newer buyers. The World War II generation's dying. We still build cars for them. And it's been in finance, too. If you can't make money in a segment, why reinvest in it? Usually for Toyota, that's an indication you got to invest more in it.
Mm-hmm.
Never give up. You know, bad minivan, you keep trying to get a good minivan. and get it right, learn from your mistakes, and it's too much of a financial model on product decisions and poor marketing choice. And
but we thought that GM learned this lesson a long time ago. The Japanese have been kicking our heads in on that front for decades. Mickey Maynard, where's the learning curve here?
Well, the learning curve starts to curve and then it stops. I mean, one of the things about this industry is that GM, Ford, and I'll wrap Chrysler in there too, they tend to declare victory before they've actually won. I mean, you get a little bit of progress, and we've all heard the stories that, oh, our quality is just as good as the Japanese.
Yeah.
And then General Motors had hundreds of millions of dollars in recalls last year. They still fail to do well on these quality surveys. And, you know, outside the Detroit area and maybe in Ohio, people don't have to buy General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler products. They can buy whatever they want. And I think that that's a huge reason why Toyota, Honda, Nissan, and some of the German companies have done so well in the last few years. The loyalty has just disappeared.
Andrew is calling from Cold Spring, Wisconsin. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. I have to be honest, you've really put a damper on my evening.
Sorry about that, my friend. How do you see it?
Well, I'll tell you that I'm not unbiased, because not too far from my hometown, or the town where I live, there is a GM plant.
How's it doing?
Well, I believe they're in a shutdown right now. It's planned to last a month, but rumors are that it might go a little longer.
How dependent is your region on those jobs?
I've got a neighbor that works there. I've got a lot of friends that work there. I mean, mm-hmm. It's an important employer. It's an important member of the community.
And overall, does it feel like it's on a curve that can come back and thrive or not, Andrew?
Well, that's my question for your guest. Now, let's be honest and objective.
You yes.
know, I'm, what, 40 years old, and I think I've heard this argument once, maybe twice before. That's it. GM's done. The Japanese have gotten beat. Their
yep.
debt's too strong.
Yep.
My honestly objective to your guests, haven't we heard this before once, and I believe twice, and haven't they come back?
Okay, Andrew, stay on the line. We want to hear if you're satisfied or not. Sean McElinden, we've heard it all before. What's new?
We have buried Detroit in the Big Three, and Mickey's done it recently many, many times in the last 25 years. And the caller's right. I don't expect GM to go away. I do expect them to get smaller, considerably smaller, maybe 18 to 20% of the market. They'll still be the biggest in the U.S. market. You know, it takes a major crisis like this sometimes to affect to bring about the largest changes. We've recently certainly seen Life and Chrysler Group, who announced a restructuring in 2001 and are certainly getting their money's worth today and are two-thirds of Daimler's world profits. So, and Ford doesn't look that gloomy at all by the end of the year, you know, with a car line that eventually I think will have some progress. So, you know, the reality of the whole situation, it's a global auto market, and you can't expect, economists never did, that three companies could take 70% of the market or 80% forever.
Yep.
I mean, IBM went through a crisis. General Electric went through a crisis. They had to restructure and transform themselves, and they do better, you know, as new companies. And I think finally GM will make another attempt, probably next month, to announce a major restructuring. And hopefully this time it's going to work.
Mickey Maynard, same question to you. Have we heard this all before? Is it qualitatively different this time? Is this just a kind of a shake-the-tree moment, and on the other side, GM will be right back out there charging forward?
No, because here's a couple reasons why. First of all, this is a 7-year decline now. So this is starting to be a structural decline, not just another cyclical problem. The second reason is that the foreign automakers are sunk into this market. By the end of, I think, next year, there will be 20 plants in this country employing over 100,000 workers.
Compared to what the GM has?
Compared to what GM has now, it would probably be... GM has about 298,000 hourly workers. So what happens is when a big three job goes away, it's replaced. It's about a 1 to 3 replacement. So for every three big three jobs that go away, there's about one new job that comes in. So it's not a 1-for-1 replacement. But another reason why it's different is something that I talked about earlier, is that loyalty is gone. If you look at the past two efforts by the industry to come back, they used that Buy American card. They used it extremely successfully in the 80s,
yes.
And they used it again in the 90s. And now, this time I don't think it works, because as Sean just said, this is a global market. A lot of people now work for global companies. There are people dining out in every kind of cuisine every night. And so the idea of buying a Toyota, especially if it's built in Kentucky or Texas, where they're building their new pickup truck plant, that just doesn't matter to as many people as it once did.
Doesn't sound like a betrayal. Andrew in Cold Spring, where does that leave you thinking? Are you putting your money in GM or not?
Well, pretty compelling arguments, but I'm still going to put my money on GM. First of all, maybe it's true many of us work for multinational companies, but I'll tell you, there's a lot of yellow ribbons on the back of GM pickup trucks in my neighborhood saying support our troops. We're very much on a pro-American, support America, nationalist bent. So,
Buy American might just still work. Andrew, we've got to go to a break. Thank you very much for your call from Cold Spring, Wisconsin. We are talking tonight about the symbol of America's 20th century industrial might, General Motors, in a fight for its life. Can you believe we're even talking about this? And how should GM fight back? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about General Motors in a very real struggle to survive, a fight for its life. You can join the conversation tonight. How are you betting on the fate of GM? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I've been joined tonight from Ann Arbor, Michigan, by Sean McAlinden. He's chief economist at the Center for Automotive Research there, and by Mickey Maynard. She is author of The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market, New York Times reporter there. We're joined now from West Bloomfield, Michigan, by Gerald Myers. He is former chairman of the American Motors Corporation. He was CEO at AMC from 1977 until 1984 when he engineered AMC's merger with Renault. He's currently an auto industry consultant and professor of business at the University of Michigan, author of When It Hits the Fan, Managing the Nine Crises of Business. Gerald Myers, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Hi, Tom.
So you're the crisis manager. Here's GM. What's your prescription, doctor?
Well, I think we need to define the problem first.
Please.
I think, unlike the doom and gloomers, GM has a great future, but it has a questionable present.
That sounds like a Zen cone. What do you mean exactly?
Well, auto companies go through boom and bust periods that are tied to two things, their product cycle and the economy. And when the two stars line up, it can be very bad news for whichever company is in line. If an auto company is on the dry end of its cycle, which is where General Motors is now and where Ford has been,
mm-hmm.
and then the economy comes along and tanks, you put the two together, that's a lot of trouble for an auto company.
Now, we heard earlier from Sean Egan and Egan Jones saying, look, they've got $300 billion in debt, interest rates are headed up, they've got pension and health obligations that are massive, their sales are flattened down, oil prices are up, and they've got SUVs, they're not ahead of the curve on hybrid electric. How do you work your way out of that?
Well, all of those things are true and more, but if you were to look at the other side of things, I think you'd find a few things that would give you pause before you bury the auto company.
We are ready to hear them.
First of all, it's commonly overlooked by us domestic types that GM has a major global structural reorganization underway. I don't want to just point to China, but they're moving very fast in China. And they will be probably the largest builder over there when China gets going. And you have to have patience, of course. It'll be a decade or so, or two or three, before that gets going.
So you're saying
one indication of what they're doing overseas. They're restructuring Europe completely. I think they're doing the right thing over there. They've had a lot of trouble over there. And I realize that the 800-pound gorilla is right here in America.
Rick Wagner said that just this week, that it's their biggest business, it's the key driver of automotive earnings. He said that it's critical for GM to get it right if it's going to survive.
And get it right they have to do. But I start at the top. I know Rick Wagner and Devine and Bob Lutz. I know them personally. I know what they do on the job. There is no finer team of top automotive executives than General Motors has over there in the Renaissance Building. I have full confidence in them, and I know what they're doing from a restructuring point of view. And I say that if they can get there, the future is bright. Now, the problem is getting there.
So restructuring, well, we heard that GM employs something like 290,000 people in the U.S. now, perhaps. When you talk about restructuring, that can mean very big downsizing moves, Gerald Meyer. So on the other side of that restructuring, do you see a smaller GM, smaller GM? Or
I do. I see it in the short run. I agree with one of your guests there who said that there's going to be some loss before there's anything gained. And in their mind, maybe nothing gained. In my mind, if we look out 10 years or even 5 years and look back, we're going to see that this was it was certainly not a glitch, but it was a very sad period for GM. They've been through it before. They've been through it, seems like, every 10 years. But as I was saying before, every auto company goes through it. Nissan went through it 5 years ago. Everyone predicted the end of Nissan. The debt was so enormous that they would just sink in the dollars that they don't have. Then Chrysler went through it. And then Ford went through it 2 years ago with the Firestone thing. And then there were grave markers up for Ford all around the place. Now it's GM's time in the barrel. And Mercedes is there, too, at the moment. This, if you take the longer view, even though there will be differences in market share and so forth, things will turn, and we'll say 5 years from now, well, it's not Nissan any, it's not GM anymore. Now it's Toyota.
So there's the light of hope, and whether it's cyclical or one way, Gerald Meyer says this is a cyclical issue, and if it just gets across this chasm, it will be back. It sounds like you believe it will. Gerald Meyer, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're quite welcome.
Gerald Meyer, former chairman of the American Motors Corporation, author of When It Hits the Fan, Managing the 9 Crises of Business. Dennis is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I read an article recently about Chinese companies poised to bring their own brand of autos to the United States in a big way.
And I've seen the picture. It's a Chery or something in 2007 coming.
Well, these articles suggested that they might even private brand them through Walmarts. And I'm wondering if...
I'll have a jug of milk and a new car, please.
That's right. And I think that... And I wonder for your panelists if this isn't... The problem with GM is symptomatic of a larger problem with our government's unwillingness to address some of the issues, such as health care, that are affecting the industry, and whether it isn't time for something like a Marshall Plan for U.S. industry. And just to that point, Brookings Institute had a report that Georgia Tech was convening a panel to decide if there was a future for engineering schools in the U.S. because of outsourcing of jobs.
What a question. What a question. Dennis, and you raise an important one. Thank you very much for that. Sean McElinden, how do you see it? Is it time for some kind of emergency measures to intervene on behalf of American industry here, whether that's health care support or protectionism or trade restraint? What do you say?
Yeah, it's funny. I was on Pennsylvania Avenue last week in Washington, and the taxi took me by the Department of Commerce building, and they had a little banner on the side of the building telling people to remember that it was Manufacturing Day, you know.
Right.
The sector's been reduced to a day.
Like Veterans Day.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a very small banner, kind of sagging. And, you know, the possibility of the United States doing away with manufacturing as an important sector, I mean, is ludicrous, ridiculous.
But Dennis says, do we need to rally as a polity somehow beyond the what's going on, what the market's doing here, to save this company, to save others, or not?
No, to a certain extent, you know, the level of the dollar, obviously the structural problems of the healthcare system, you know, it put American manufacturing in one of the deepest holes it's ever been in, and part of that cyclical, obviously, it's very structural. We do need an enormous amount of attention, we think, here in the Midwest, on this, you know, manufacturing needs, and we do need, we think, a national effort, you know, at the Washington level. Hopefully, maybe even as big as foreign policy, if that could be dreamt of.
If that could be, but things are pretty big on that side right now. Mickey Maynard,
yeah, it seems to take away every ounce of attention.
Yeah, we hear you, and we see it. Mickey, how do you see it? Here's a citizen honestly asking, you know, the idea of GM falling down or getting a whole lot smaller is unnerving to a lot of Americans. Is there something that ought to be done beyond just waiting for the guys, the brilliant guys in the Renaissance building, to pull it out?
Well, I actually think the brilliant guys in the Renaissance building should be pulling it out themselves, and I'll give you an example why. My beat at the New York Times is the airline industry, and I've covered, I think, 5 bankruptcies in the last 3 years. And in each of those bankruptcies, what the airlines typically do is they go to bankruptcy court and they abrogate their contracts. And one of the things that they're allowed to do is eliminate things like post-retirement health care for their employees. In the case of the auto industry, in 1982, in both Canada and the United States, the companies got together with the UAW and they basically rewrote their contracts. They froze wages and they went at some cost-cutting issues that helped the industry tremendously at that time. There's been no talk of a reopener between the UAW and General Motors, and I think that anybody in Washington would say try to fix the problem with a reopener first.
In other words, open the contract.
Yes, renegotiate the contract.
Cut wages, cut benefits.
I'm just suggesting that this was done once before. There is a precedent for this. Congress helped Chrysler, for example, but one of the reasons why Chrysler got a bailout was that the UAW agreed to concessions back in 1980. So there are still steps that can be taken by the car companies short of congressional action.
Sean McElinden, we hear you protesting something in the background there. Are you saying this won't happen or shouldn't happen?
The airlines are a fairly poor example. We're not going to go Chapter 11 in the auto industry because you declare Chapter 11 like the airlines did and consumers stop buying your cars. I mean, who's going to buy a car from a Chapter 11 company?
Well, people still fly Chapter 11 airlines every single day.
You're talking about the price of an airline ticket. You're not talking about a $30,000 vehicle.
Oh, boy. And with that, off we go, talking about General Motors and bankruptcy in the same breath at the end of our time. I'm grateful to both of you tonight. Micheline Maynard, author of The End of Detroit, New York Times reporter based in Ann Arbor. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Sean McElinden at the Center for Automotive Research. Thank you for joining us.
All right.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Are we going to have energy production in this country or not? Are we going to continue to put various areas off limits where we cannot have more production?
We know that the amount of oil generated from this, according to the president's own economic advisors, will have a negligible impact on oil prices. Maybe that's because there is no guarantee that the revenue collected from this or the oil from the Arctic Wildlife Refuge will be kept in America.
So that there is no misunderstanding from my perspective, I will suspend any player who tests positive for an illegal steroid. There will be no exceptions. The union is aware of that, and they accept it.
To friends, family, and millions of people praying around the world this Palm Sunday weekend, don't be afraid. Terry Schiavo will not be forsaken.
I just ask those people to understand and to understand there is another point of view, and it's because I believe keeping someone from getting to heaven is the wrong thing to do.
There's been a ceasefire now for, 11 years, 94. There's been a peace process for 7 years, but still here you have in Ireland, after all of that, men who can murder in the streets and walk away accountable to no one because they belong to an organization.
Paul is committed to development. He's a compassionate, decent man who will do a fine job in the World Bank.
This just proves that when you don't use ethics, when you take your power and misuse it, that there is a price to pay. And I think for many of the people who were impacted by WorldCom's misdeeds through Bernie Evers and Scott Sullivan, this is a good closure point.
And there is a week. The U.S. Senate gives a green light to oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. More to come there. Baseball stars Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa and Commissioner Bud Selig are among the witnesses called to testify before a House committee looking into steroid use in the major leagues. The feeding tube is removed from Terry Schiavo, the Florida woman who has been in what doctors call a persistent vegetative state for 15 years. Catherine McCartney, whose brother was allegedly murdered by IRA members in Belfast, meets with President Bush on St. Patrick's Day. President Bush nominates Paul Wolfowitz to head up the World Bank, and former WorldCom CEO Bernard Ebbers is convicted of fraud, becoming the highest-profile executive convicted in the accounting scandals that have rocked the corporate world since the end of the 90s boom. Jack, plenty afoot there this week.
Yes, and really something very important happened in Congress. It wasn't the passage of yet another tax cut, this one essentially eliminating the tax cut, the tax increase of 1993 on affluent Social Security earners. That's gone, $64 billion. And it wasn't even ANWR, the opening up of the Arctic wilderness to drilling. I mean, we've seen this oligarchy that seems to be evolving in Washington, giving away gift after gift to corporate interests. No, I think the significant thing was the defeat of the Feingold Amendment. Russ Feingold, senator from Wisconsin, proposed a reinstatement of the amendment that really kept congressional spending in line during the 90s and helped us work toward a balanced budget. That was the pay-as-you-go stipulation. In other words, if you wanted to have a tax increase, if you wanted to have a tax cut, you had to pay for it with either spending cuts or a tax increase someplace else.
And this week that's gone, Jack?
Republicans voted that down. We have no pay-as-you-go, and instead, Congress voted down the president's effort to cut back on Medicaid, which I think probably was a good thing. Nevertheless, it was the only serious budget reduction program he had. They voted that down. They voted for a tax cut, and they said, we don't want any discipline here. We're going to – no, those days are gone.
So the lid really, is off.
The lid is off. And, you know, I mean, we learned that the administration wasn't serious about really cutting the deficit, as people have pointed out, including the Congressional Budget Office. But we, there was some hope that maybe the Congress would. This week showed that isn't so.
Americans pay close attention. That is our children and grandchildren's lives kind of there.
That's it. They're going to do all this paying. And, of course, you know, we're at the same time, President Bush and some of these Republicans are professing great solicitude for our, you know, our young people in the future. Well, my gosh, all of this debt is being put on them.
At the other end of the age scale, we lost a big one this week. George Kennan, 101 years old, one of the great diplomats and global strategists of the 20th century.
Yes, you know, and really one of the most distinguished Americans of the 20th century, a man of letters, multiple winner of the Pulitzer Prize, National Book Award, historian, essayist, diplomat, analyst of foreign policy, and consistent sort of astringent moralist, forever criticizing American foreign policy for its addiction to moralism, to legalism, and for the militarization of foreign policy that really came over the country in the Cold War. And again, Kennan, in his writings, which are nothing if not elegant, basically says, remember, we have limitations. He writes, let us recognize that there are no problems in this world that there are problems in this world we will not be able to solve, depths into which it will not be useful or effective for us to plunge, dilemmas in other regions of the globe that will have to find their solution without our involvement. How that chastening realism seems so foreign today with our freedom everywhere. That's our mission, goal, and foreign policy.
I remember reading him as a young man and being absolutely thrilled at that kind of elegance of mind in Real Power. Hate to say they don't make them like that anymore. Maybe we will. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight. Have a good weekend.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.